And what about you? Sylvia said. Any grandkids? Our oldest son, Gary, has three sons, but so that's interesting, a 5-year gap between the youngest and the next youngest? Nearly 6, actually. And your son in New York. I want to hear about him, too. Did you stop and see him today? Yes, he made a lovely lunch, but we didn't get down to see his office at the Wall Street Journal, where he has a new job, because the weather was so bad. So, and do you get out much to California to see your grandsons? Some spirit, a willingness to play the game, left Sylvia. She sat peering into her empty soda glass. "Enid, will you do me a favor?" she said finally. "Come upstairs and have a nightcap." Enid's day had begun in St. Jude at 5 in the morning, but she never declined an attractive invitation. Upstairs, in a Lagerkvist taproom, she and Sylvia were served by a dwarf in a horned helmet and leather jerkin who persuaded them to order cloudberry aquavit. "I want to tell you something," Sylvia said, "because I have to tell someone on the ship, but you can't breathe a word of this to anyone. Are you good at keeping secrets?" "It's one thing I do well." "Then good," Sylvia said. 3 days from now, there's going to be an execution in Pennsylvania. So, and 2 days after that, on Thursday, Ted and I have our 40th anniversary. And if you ask Ted, he'll tell you that's why we're on this cruise for the anniversary. He'll tell you that, but it's not the truth. Or it's only a truth about Ted, and not me. Enid felt afraid. "The man who's being executed," Sylvia Roth said, "killed our daughter."
"No."
The blue clarity of Sylvia's gaze made her seem a beautiful, lovable animal that was not, however, quite human. "Ted and I," she said, "are on this cruise because we have a problem with this execution. We have a problem with each other."
"No. What are you telling me?" Enid shuddered. "Oh, I can't stand to hear this. I can't stand to hear this."
Sylvia quietly registered this allergy to her disclosure.
"I'm sorry," she said. "It's not fair of me to ambush you. Maybe we should call it a night."
But Enid quickly regained her composure. She was determined not to miss becoming Sylvia's confidant.
"Tell me everything you need to tell me," she said, "and I'll listen."
She folded her hands in her lap like a good listener.
"Go ahead. I'm listening."
"Then the other thing I have to tell you," Sylvia said, "is that I'm a gun artist. I draw guns. You really want to hear this?"
"Yes."
Enid nodded eagerly and vaguely. The dwarf, she noticed, used a small ladder to fetch down bottles.
"Interesting."
For many years, Sylvia said, she'd been an amateur printmaker. She had a sun-filled studio in her house in Chad's Ford. She had a cream-smooth lithography stone and a 20-piece set of German woodblock chisels. And she belonged to a Wilmington art guild in whose semi-annual show, while her youngest child, Jordan, grew from a tomboy into an independent young woman, she'd sold decorative prints for prices like $40. Then Jordan was murdered, and for 5 years Sylvia printed, drew, and painted nothing but guns. Year after year, only guns.
"Terrible. Terrible," Enid said with open disapproval.
The trunk of the wind-splintered tulip tree outside Sylvia's studio suggested stocks and barrels. Every human form sought to become a hammer, a trigger guard, a cylinder, a grip. There was no abstraction that couldn't be tracer fire or the smoke of black powder or a hollow point's flowering. The body was world-like in the repleteness of its possibilities, and just as no part of this little world was safe from a bullet's penetration, no form in the big world had no echo in a gun. Even a pinto bean was like a derringer. Even a snowflake like a Browning on its tripod. Sylvia wasn't insane. She could force herself to draw a circle or sketch a rose, but what she hungered to draw was firearms. Guns, gunfire, ordnance, projectiles. She spent hours capturing in pencil the pattern of gleam on nickel plating. Sometimes she also drew her hands and her wrists and forearms in what she guessed, for she had never held a gun, were appropriate grips for a 50-caliber Desert Eagle, a 9mm Glock, a fully automatic M16 with a folding aluminum stock, and other exotic weapons from the catalogs that she kept in brown envelopes in her sun-drenched studio. She abandoned herself to her habit like a lost soul to its hellishly fitting occupation. Although Chad's Ford, the subtle warblers that ventured up from the Brandywine, the scents of warm cattail and fermenting persimmon that October winds stirred out of nearby hollows, staunchly resisted being made a hell of. She was a Sisypha who every night destroyed her own creations, tore them up, erased them in mineral spirits, kindled a merry fire in the living room.
"Terrible," Enid murmured again. "I can't think of a worse thing that could happen to a mother."
She signaled to the dwarf for more cloudberry aquavit. Some mysteries of her obsession, Sylvia said, were that she'd been raised as a Quaker and still went to meeting in Kennett Square, that the tools of Jordan's torture and murder had been one roll of nylon-reinforced strapping tape, one dish towel, two wire coat hangers, one General Electric light and easy electric iron, and one WMF 12-inch serrated bread knife from Williams-Sonoma, that is, no guns. That the killer, a 19-year-old named Kelly Withers, had turned himself in to the Philadelphia police without, again, a gun, being unholstered. That with a husband who earned a huge late-career salary as DuPont's vice president of compliance and a sport utility vehicle so massive that a head-on crash with a VW cabriolet might hardly have dented it, and a 6-bedroom Queen Anne-style house into whose kitchen and pantry Jordan's entire Philadelphia apartment would have fit comfortably, Sylvia enjoyed a life of almost senseless ease and comfort in which her only task, besides cooking for Ted, literally her only task, was to recover from Jordan's death. That she nevertheless often became so absorbed in rendering the tooling on a revolver butt or the veins in her arm that she had to drive crazily fast to avoid missing her thrice-weekly therapy with an MD-PhD in Wilmington. That by talking to the MD-PhD and by attending Wednesday night sessions with other parents of victims of violence and Thursday night meetings with her older women's group, and by reading the poetry and novels and memoirs and insight books that her friends recommended, and by relaxing with yoga and horseback riding, and by volunteering as a physical therapist's assistant at Children's Hospital, she succeeded in working through her grief even as her compulsion to draw guns intensified. That she mentioned this compulsion to no one, not even to the MD-PhD in Wilmington. That her friends and advisors all constantly exhorted her to heal herself through her art, that by art they meant her decorative woodcuts and lithos. That when she happened to see an old woodcut of hers in the bathroom or guest bedroom of a friend, she twisted her body with shame at the fraudulence. That when she saw guns on TV or in a movie, she writhed in a similar way and for similar reasons. That she was secretly convinced, in other words, that she had become a real artist, a genuinely good artist of the gun. That it was the proof of this artistry that she destroyed at the end of each day. That she was convinced that Jordan, despite having earned a BFA in painting and an MA in art therapy, and despite the encouragement and paid instruction in art she'd received for 20 years, had not been a good artist. That after achieving this objective view of her dead daughter, she continued to draw guns and ammo. And that in spite of the rage and thirst for vengeance that her continuing obsession obviously betokened, she had never once in 5 years drawn the face of Kelly Withers. On the October morning, when these mysteries impressed themselves on her en masse, Sylvia took the stairs to her studio after breakfast at a run. On a sheet of ivory Canson paper, and using a mirror so that it appeared to be her right hand, she drew her left hand, with its thumb raised and fingers curled, 60 degrees behind full profile, a nearly full rear view. This hand she then filled with a snub-nosed 38 revolver, expertly foreshortened, whose barrel penetrated a pair of smirking lips, above which she penciled, accurately, from memory, the taunting eyes of Kelly Withers. Over the recent exhaustion of whose legal appeals, few tears had been shed. And at that, a pair of lips, a pair of eyes, Sylvia had set down her pencil.
"It was time to move on," Sylvia said to Enid. "I saw it all of a sudden, that whether I liked it or not, the survivor and the artist was me, not her. We're all conditioned to think of our children as more important than us, you know, and to live vicariously through them. All of a sudden I was sick of that kind of thinking. I may be dead tomorrow, I said to myself, but I'm alive now, and I can live deliberately. I've paid the price, I've done the work, and I have nothing to be ashamed of. And when the event, the big change in your life, is simply an insight, isn't that a strange thing? That absolutely nothing changes except that you see things differently, and you're less fearful and less anxious and generally stronger as a result. Isn't it amazing that a completely invisible thing in your head can feel realer than anything you've experienced before? You see things more clearly, and you know that you're seeing them more clearly. And it comes to you that this is what it means to love life. This is all anybody who talks seriously about God is ever talking about. Moments like this."
"Maybe one more?"
Enid said to the dwarf, raising her glass. She was almost wholly not listening to Sylvia, but shaking her head and murmuring, and "oh," while her consciousness stumbled through clouds of alcohol into such absurd realms of speculation as how the dwarf might feel against her hips and belly, embracing her. Sylvia turned out to be very intellectual, and Enid felt befriended under somewhat false pretenses. But while not listening, she also had to listen, because she was missing certain key facts, such as whether Kelly Withers was black, and whether Jordan had been brutally raped. From her studio, Sylvia had gone straight to a Wawa food market and brought one of every dirty magazine it had in stock. Nothing she found in the magazines was sufficiently hardcore, however. She needed to see the actual plumbing, the literal act. She returned to Chad's Ford and switched on the computer that her younger son had given her to foster closeness in their time of loss. Her email box contained a month's backlog of filial greetings that she ignored. In less than 5 minutes, she located the goods she wanted. All it took was a credit card, and she moused through thumbnail views until she found the necessary angle on the necessary act with the necessary actors. Black man performing oral sex on white man, camera shooting over left hip, 60 degrees behind full profile, crescent of high values curving over buttock, knuckles of black fingers duskily visible in their probing on the dark side of this moon. She downloaded the image and viewed it at high resolution. She was 65 years old, and she'd never seen a scene like this. She'd fashioned images all her life, and she'd never appreciated their mystery. Now here it was. All this commerce in bits and bytes, these ones and zeros streaming through servers at some Midwestern university. So much evident trafficking and so much evident nothing. A population glued to screens and magazines. She wondered, how could people respond to these images if images didn't secretly enjoy the same status as real things? Not that images were so powerful, but that the world was so weak. It could be vivid, certainly, in its weakness, as on days when the sun baked fallen apples in orchards and the valley smelled like cider, and cold nights when Jordan had driven to Chad's Ford for dinner and the tires of her cabriolet had crunched on the gravel driveway. But the world was fungible only as images. Nothing got inside the head without becoming pictures. And yet Sylvia was struck by the contrast between the online porn and her unfinished drawing of Withers. Unlike ordinary lust, which could be appeased by pictures or by pure imagination, the lust for revenge could not be tricked. The most graphic image couldn't satisfy it. This lust required the death of a specific individual, the termination of a specific history. As the menus said, no substitutions. She could draw her desire, but not its fulfillment. And so she finally told herself the truth. She wanted Kelly Withers dead. She wanted him dead despite her recent interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer, in which she'd avowed that killing someone else's child wouldn't bring back her own. She wanted him dead despite the religious fervor with which her M.D. Ph.D. had forbidden her to interpret Jordan's death religiously, for example, as a divine judgment on her own liberal politics or liberal parenting or senseless affluence. She wanted him dead despite believing that Jordan's death had been a random tragedy and that redemption lay not in vengeance but in reducing the incidence of random tragedies nationwide. She wanted him dead despite imagining a society that provided jobs at a decent wage for young men like him, so that he would not have had to bind the wrists and ankles of his former art therapist and bully out of her the passwords for her bank card and credit cards. A society that staunched the flow of illegal drugs into urban neighborhoods, so that Withers could not have spent the stolen money on crack, and would have had more mental clarity when he returned to the apartment of his former art therapist, and would not have proceeded to smoke the rock and torture her on and off for 30 hours. A society in which young men had more to believe in than brand-name consumer goods, so that Withers would have fixated less insanely on his former art therapist's cabriolet and would have believed her when she insisted she'd lent the car to a friend for the weekend and would have set less store by her possession of 2 sets of keys. Couldn't get around that, he explained in his partially coerced but still legally admissible confession. All the keys right there on the kitchen table, you know what I'm saying? Couldn't get my ass around that fact. And would not have repeatedly applied the victim's light and easy iron to her bare skin and advanced the temperature setting from rayon up through cotton linen while demanding to know where she'd parked the cabriolet, and would not have cut her throat in a panic when her friend came by on Sunday evening to return the car and her 3rd set of keys. A society that once and for all put an end to the physical abuse of children, so that it would have been absurd for a convicted murderer to claim, in the sentencing phase of his trial, that his stepfather had burned him with an electric iron when he was little. Though in the case of Withers, who had no burn scars to exhibit, such testimony seemed mainly to underscore the convict's own lack of imagination as a liar. She wanted him dead despite even her realization in therapy that his smirk had been a protective mask donned by a lonely boy surrounded by people who hated him, and that if she'd only smiled at him like a forgiving mother, he might have laid aside his mask and wept with honest remorse. She wanted him dead despite knowing her desire would please conservatives for whom the phrase personal responsibility constituted permission to ignore social injustice. She wanted him dead, despite being unable, for these political reasons, to attend the execution and to see with her own eyes the thing for which no image could substitute. "But none of this," she said, "is why we're on this cruise."
"No?"
Enid said, as if awakening. "No. We're here because Ted won't admit that Jordan was murdered."
"Is he—"
"Oh, he knows it," Sylvia said. "He just won't talk about it. He was very close to Jordan, closer in a lot of ways than he's ever been to me. And he grieved, I'll grant him that, he did grieve. He wept so much he could hardly move. But then one morning he was over it. He said that Jordan was gone, and he wasn't going to live in the past. He said that starting on Labor Day he was going to forget she was a victim. And every day, as it got later in August, he reminded me that beginning after Labor Day he wouldn't admit that she was murdered. Ted's a very rational man. His view was that human beings have been losing children forever, and that too much grieving is stupid and self-indulgent. He didn't care what happened to Withers, either. He said that following the trial was just another way of not getting over the murder. And so, on Labor Day, He said to me, "It may seem strange to you, but I will never speak of her death again, and I want you to remember that I'm telling you this. Will you remember this, Sylvia, so you don't think I'm crazy later?" And I said, "I don't like this, Ted. I don't accept this." And he said he was sorry, but he had to do it. And the next night, when he got home from work, I told him, I think it was, that Withers's lawyer was claiming his confession was coerced and the real killer was still at large. And Ted sort of grinned at me in this way when he's pulling your leg, and he said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And so I actually said, "I'm talking about the person who killed our daughter." And he said, "No one killed our daughter. I don't want to hear you say that again." And I said, "Ted, this is not going to work." And he said, "What's not going to work?" And I said, "You're pretending Jordan isn't dead." And he said, "We had a daughter, and we don't now, and so I guess she's dead. But I'm warning you, Sylvia, you do not tell me she was killed. Do you understand me?" And ever since then, Enid, no matter how hard I push, he's never dropped his pose. And I'll tell you, I'm an inch away from divorcing him. Always. Except he's so unfailingly dear to me otherwise. He never gets angry when I talk about Withers. He just gets bluff and laughs it off like it's some peculiar idée fixe of mine. And I can see that he's like our cat dragging in a dead warbler. The cat doesn't know you don't like dead warblers. Ted wants me to be rational like he is. He thinks he's doing me a favor, and he takes me on all these trips and cruises, and everything's fine, except that for him, the most terrible thing in our life didn't happen, and for me it did. "So did it happen?" Enid said. Sylvia drew her head back, shocked. "Thank you," she said, although Enid had posed the question because she was momentarily confused, not because she wanted to do Sylvia a favor. "Thank you for being honest enough to ask me that. I do feel crazy sometimes. All my work is in my head. I'm moving around a million little pieces of nothing, a million thoughts and feelings and memories inside my head, day after day. For years, there's this enormous scaffolding and planning, like I'm building a cathedral of toothpicks inside my head. And it doesn't even help to keep a diary, because I can't make the words on the page have any effect on my brain. As soon as I write a thing down, I leave it behind. It's like dropping pennies over the side of a boat. And so I'm doing all this mental work without any possibility of external support, except for these slightly dowdy people in my Wednesday and Thursday groups. And meanwhile, my own husband is pretending that the whole point of all this huge interior work, namely that my daughter was murdered, isn't real. And so more and more, literally the only beacons I still have in my life, my only north and south and east and west, are my emotions. And Ted's right on top of that. He thinks our culture attaches too much importance to feelings. He says it's out of control. It's not computers that are making everything virtual. It's mental health. Everyone's trying to correct their thoughts and improve their feelings and work on their relationships and parenting skills instead of just getting married and raising children like they used to, is what Ted says. We've bumped up to the next level of abstraction because we have too much time and money, is what he says. And he refuses to be a part of it. He wants to eat real food and go to real places and talk about real things like business and science. So he and I don't really agree at all anymore on what's important in life. And he foxed my therapist, Enid. I had her to dinner so she could take a look at him, and you know those dinners the magazines say you shouldn't make for company when you're in the kitchen for 20 minutes before every course? I made one of those. A risotto milanese, and then pan-fried steaks with a 2-stage reduction, and my therapist was out in the dining room the whole time, quizzing Ted. And when I saw her the next day, she said, his condition was very common in men. He appeared to have dealt with his grief enough to function, and she believed he wasn't going to change, and it was up to me now to accept this. And you know, I'm not supposed to let myself think magical or religious thoughts, but one thought I can't escape is that this crazy thirst for revenge I've had for all these years isn't really my own. It's Ted's. He won't deal with it himself, and somebody's got to deal with it, so I do. Like I'm a surrogate mother, except I'm not carrying a baby, I'm carrying emotions. Maybe if Ted had taken more responsibility for his feelings, and been less in a hurry to go back to work at DuPont, I would have stayed just like I always was, and sold my woodcuts at the Guild every Christmas. Maybe it was Ted's being so rational and businesslike that pushed me over the edge. And so maybe the moral of this long story, which you've been a total dear to listen to, Enid, is that I can't stop finding a moral to the story, no matter how hard I try not to. To Enid at this moment came a vision of rain. She saw herself in a house with no walls. To keep the weather out, all she had was tissue. And here came the rain from the east, and she tacked up a tissue version of Chip and his exciting new job as a reporter. Here it came from the west, and the tissue was how handsome and intelligent Gary's boys were and how much she loved them. Then the wind shifted, and she ran to the north side of the house with such shreds of tissue as Denise afforded, how she'd married too young but was older and wiser now and enjoying great success as a restaurateur and hoping to meet the right young man. And then the rain came blasting up from the south, the tissue disintegrating, even as she insisted that Al's impairments were very mild, and he'd be fine if he'd just work on his attitude and get his drugs adjusted. And it rained harder and harder, and she was so tired. And all she had was tissue.
"Sylvia," she said.
"Yes?"
"I need to tell you something. It's about my husband."
Eager, perhaps, to repay the favor of listening, Sylvia nodded with encouragement. But suddenly she reminded Enid of Katharine Hepburn. In Hepburn's eyes, there had been a blank unconsciousness of privilege that made a once poor woman like Enid want to kick her patrician shins with the hardest toed pumps at her disposal. It would be a mistake, she felt, to confess anything to this woman.
"Yes?" Sylvia prompted.
"Nothing. I'm sorry."
"No, say. Nothing, really, just that I must get to bed. There's certainly lots to do tomorrow."
She rose unsteadily and let Sylvia sign for the drinks. They rode an elevator in silence. Too precipitous intimacy had left in its wake a kind of dirty awkwardness. When Sylvia stepped out at the upper deck level, however, Enid followed. She couldn't bear to be seen by Sylvia as a B-deck sort of person. Sylvia stopped by the door of a large outside stateroom.
"Where's your room?"
"Just down the hall here," Enid said.
But this pretense, she saw, was unsustainable. Tomorrow she would have to pretend she'd been confused.
"Good night, then," Sylvia said. "Thanks again for listening."
She waited with a gentle smile for Enid to move on, but Enid didn't move on. She looked around uncertainly.
"I'm sorry. What deck is this?"
"This is the upper."
"Oh, dear, I'm on the wrong deck. I'm sorry."
"Don't be sorry. Do you want me to walk you down?"
"No, I got confused. I see now this is the upper deck, and I'm supposed to be on a lower deck, a much lower deck, so I'm sorry."
She turned away, but still she didn't leave.
"My husband..."
She shook her head.
"No, our son, actually. We didn't have lunch with him today. That's what I wanted to tell you. He met us at the airport, and we were supposed to have lunch with him and his friend, but they just left. I don't understand it, and he never came back, and we still don't know where he went, so anyway."
"That is peculiar," Sylvia agreed.
"So I don't want to bore you."
"No, no, no, Enid. Shame on you.
I just wanted to straighten that out, and now I'm off to bed, so, and I'm so glad we met. There's a lot to do tomorrow, so we'll see you at breakfast."
Before Sylvia could stop her, Enid sidled up the corridor. She needed surgery on her hip, but imagine leaving Al at home alone while she was in the hospital. Just imagine. Castigating herself for blundering down a hall she didn't belong on and blurting out shameful nonsense about her son. She veered to a cushioned bench and slumped, and did, now, burst into tears. God had given her the imagination to weep for the sad strivers who booked the most El Cheapo B-deck inside staterooms on a luxury cruise ship. but a childhood without money had left her unable to stomach herself the $300 per person it cost to jump one category up. And so she wept for herself. She felt that she and Al were the only intelligent people of her generation who had managed not to become rich. Here was a torture that the Greek inventors of the feast and the stone had omitted from their Hades, the blanket of self-deception. A lovely warm blanket as far as it covered the soul in torment. But it never quite covered everything. And the nights were getting cold now. She considered returning to Sylvia's room and fully unburdening herself, but then, through her tears, she saw a sweet thing beneath the bench beside her. It was a $10 bill, folded once. Very sweet. With a glance up the corridor, she reached down. The texture of engraving was delicious. Feeling restored, she descended to the B deck. Background music whispered in the lounge, something perky with accordions. She imagined she heard her name bleated distantly as she fitted her key card in the lock and pushed on her door. She encountered resistance and pushed harder. "Enid!" Alfred bleated from the other side. "Shh, Al! What on earth?" Life as she knew it ended with her squeeze through the half-open door. Diurnality yielded to a raw continuum of hours. She found Alfred naked, with his back to the door, on a layer of bedsheets spread on sections of morning paper from St. Jude. Pants and a sport coat and a tie were laid out on his bed, which he'd stripped to the mattress. The excess bedding he'd piled on the other bed. He continued to call her name even after she'd turned on a light and occupied his field of vision. Her immediate aim was to quiet him and get some pajamas on him, but this took time, for he was terribly agitated and not finishing his sentences, not even making his verbs and nouns agree in number and person. He believed that it was morning, and he had to bathe and dress, and that the floor by the door was a bathtub, and that the handle was a faucet, and that nothing worked. Still, he insisted on doing everything his way, which led to a pushing and pulling, an actual blow to her shoulder. He raged, and she wept and abused him. He managed with his madly flopping hands to unbutton his pajama top as fast as she could button it. She'd never heard him use the words T-U-R-D or C-R-A-P, and the fluency with which he used them now illuminated years of prior silent usage in his head. He unmade her bed while she tried to remake his. She begged him to sit still. He cried that it was very late and he was very confused. Even now, she couldn't help loving him. Maybe especially now. Maybe she'd known all along for 50 years that there was this little boy in him. Maybe all the love she'd given Chipper and Gary, all the love for which in the end she'd got so little in return, had merely been practice for this most demanding of her children. She soothed and berated him, and silently cursed his addling medications for an hour or more, and finally he was asleep, and her travel clock showed 5:10 and 7:30, and he was running his electric shaver. Not having gone properly under, she felt fine getting up and fine dressing, and catastrophically bad going to breakfast, her tongue like a dust mop, her head like something on a spit. Even for a big ship, the sea this morning was poor footing. The regurgitative splats outside the Kierkegaard room were almost rhythmic, a kind of music of chance. And Mrs. Nygren informatively brayed about the evils of caffeine, and the quasi-bicamerality of the storting, and the cerebloids arrived damp from intimate Swedish exertions, and somehow Al proved equal to conversation with Ted Roth. Enid and Sylvia resumed relations stiffly, their emotional muscles pulled and aching from last night's overuse. They talked about the weather. An activities coordinator named Susie Gosh came by with orientative tidings and registration forms for the afternoon's outings in Newport, Rhode Island. With a bright smile and anticipatory noises, Enid signed up for a tour of the town's historic homes, and then watched in dismay as everyone else but the Norwegian social lepers passed along the clipboard without registering.
"Sylvia," she chid, her voice shaking, "you're not going on the tour?"
Sylvia glanced at her bespectacled husband, who nodded like McGeorge Bundy green-lighting ground troops for Vietnam, and for a moment her blue eyes seemed to look inward. Apparently she had that ability of the enviable, of the non-Midwestern, of the moneyed, to assess her desires without regard to social expectations or moral imperatives.
"Okay, yes, good," she said. "Maybe I will."
Ordinarily, Enid would have squirmed at the hint of charity here. But she was waiving the oral exam for gift horses today. She needed all the charity she could get. And so on up the day's steep incline she labored, availing herself of a complimentary half-session of Swedish massage, watching coastal leaves senesce from the Ibsen promenade, and downing 6 ibuprofens and a quart of coffee to prepare for her afternoon in charming and historic Newport. In which freshly rain-laundered port of call, Alfred announced that his feet hurt too much to venture ashore, and Enid made him promise not to nap or he wouldn't sleep at night, and she laughingly—for how could she admit that it was life and death—implored Ted Roth to keep him awake, and Ted replied that getting the Newgrens off the ship ought to help with that. Smells of sun-warmed creosote and cold mussels, of boat fuel and football fields and drying kelp— an almost genetic nostalgia for things maritime and things autumnal beset Enid as she limped from the gangway toward the tour bus. The day was dangerously beautiful. Big gusts and related clouds and a fierce lion of a sun blew the gaze around, agitating Newport's white clabbered and mown greens, making them unseeable straight on. "Folks," the tour guide urged, "just sit back and drink it in." But that which can be drunk can also drown. Enid had slept for 6 of the previous 55 hours, and even as Sylvia thanked her for inviting her along, she found she had no energy for touring. The Astors and the Vanderbilts, their pleasure domes and money, she was sick of it. Sick of envying, sick of herself. She didn't understand antiques or architecture. She couldn't draw like Sylvia. She didn't read like Ted. She had few interests and no expertise. A capacity for love was the only true thing she'd ever had. And so she tuned out the tour guide and heeded the October angle of the yellow light, the heart-mangling intensities of the season. In the wind pushing waves across the bay, she could smell night's approach. It was coming at her fast, mystery and pain, and a strange, yearning sense of possibility, as though heartbreak were a thing to be sought and moved toward. On the bus between Rosecliff and the lighthouse, Sylvia offered Enid a cell phone so she could give Chip a call. Enid declined, since cell phones $8, and she thought a person might incur charges simply by touching one, but she made this statement. "It's been years, Sylvia, since we had a relationship with him. I don't think he tells us the truth about what he's doing with his life. He said once he was working for the Wall Street Journal. Maybe I misheard him, but I think that's what he said, but I don't think that's really where he's working. I don't know what he does for a living, really." "You must think it's awful of me to complain about this when you've had things so much worse." In Sylvia's insistence that it wasn't awful, not at all, Enid glimpsed how she might confess an even more shameful thing or two, and how this exposure to the public elements might, while painful, offer solace. But like so many phenomena that were beautiful at a distance, thunderheads, volcanic eruptions, the stars and planets— this alluring pain proved at closer range to be inhuman in its scale. From Newport, the Gunnar Myrdal sailed east into sapphire vapors. The ship felt stifling to Enid after an afternoon's exposure to big skies and the tanker-sized playpens of the super-wealthy. And though she won $60 more in the Stringbird room, she felt like a lab animal caged with other lever-yanking animals amid the mechanized blink and burble, and bedtime came early. and when Alfred began to stir, she was already awake, listening to the anxiety bell ringing with such force that her bed frame vibrated and her sheets were abrasive, and here was Alfred turning on lights and shouting, and a next-door neighbor banging on the wall and shouting back, and Alfred stock still, listening with his face twisted in paranoid psychosis, and then whispering conspiratorially that he'd seen a T-U-R-D run between the beds, and then the making and unmaking of said beds, the application of a diaper, the application of a second diaper to address some hallucinated exigency, and the balking of his nerve-damaged legs, and the bleating of the word Enid until he nearly wore it out, and the woman with the rawly abraded name, sobbing in the dark, with the worst despair and anxiety she'd ever felt, until finally, like an overnight traveler arriving at a train station differing from the dismal ones before it, only in the morning twilight the small miracles of restored visibility, a chalky puddle in a gravel parking lot, the steam twisting from a sheet metal chimney, she was brought to a decision. On her map of the ship, at the stern end of the D-deck, was the universal symbol of aid for those in need. After breakfast, she left her husband in conversation with the Roths and made her way to this red cross. The physical thing corresponding to the symbol was a frosted glass door with three words lettered on in gold leaf. Alfred was the first word, and infirmary was the third. The sense of the middle word was lost in the shadows cast by Alfred. She studied it fruitlessly. No. Bell. Knob L. No bell. All three words retreated as the door was pulled open by a muscular young man with a name tag pinned to a white lapel. Mather Hibbard, M.D. He had a large, somewhat coarse-skinned face, like the face of the Italian-American actor people loved, the one who once starred as an angel and another time as a disco dancer. "Hi, how are you this morning?" he said, showing pearly teeth. Enid followed him through a vestibule into the inner office, where he directed her to the chair by his desk.
"I'm Mrs. Lambert," she said. "Enid Lambert in B-11. I was hoping you could help me."
"I hope so, too. What seems to be the problem?"
"I'm having some trouble."
"Mental trouble? Emotional trouble?"
"Well, it's my husband. Excuse me. Stop, stop."
Dr. Hibbard ducked a little and smiled impishly. "You say you're having the trouble?" His smile was adorability itself. It took hostage that part of Enid that melted at the sight of seal pups and kittens, and it refused to release her until, somewhat grudgingly, she'd smiled back.
"My trouble," she said, "is my husband and my children.
Sorry again, Edith. Time out." Dr. Hibbard ducked very low, put his hands on his head, and peered up from between his arms. "We need to be clear. You are the one having trouble?"
"No, I'm fine. But everyone else in my..."
"Are you anxious?"
"Yes, but..."
"Not sleeping?"
"Exactly. You see, my husband..."
"Edith." "You said Edith?"
"Enid. Lambert, L-A-M-B.
Enith, what's 4 times 7 with 3 taken away?"
"What? Oh, well, 25.
"And what day of the week is it today?"
"Today's Monday."
"And what historic Rhode Island resort town did we visit yesterday?"
"Newport."
"And are you currently taking medication for depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, epilepsy, Parkinsonism, or any other psychiatric or neurologic disorder?"
"No."
Dr. Hibbard nodded and sat up straight, rolled open a deep drawer in the console behind him, and withdrew a handful of rattling plastic and foil packages. He counted off 8 of them and set them on his desk in front of Enid. They had an expensive sheen she didn't like the looks of. "This is an excellent new medication that will help you enormously," Hibbard recited in a monotone. He winked at her.
"Excuse me?
Have we misunderstood each other? I believe you said I am having trouble, and mentioned anxiety and sleep disturbance."
"Yes, but what I meant was that my husband..."
"Husband, right, or wife, it's often the less inhibited spouse that comes to see me. In fact, a crippling fear of asking for Aslan is the condition for which Aslan is most commonly indicated. The drug exerts a remarkable blocking effect on deep or morbid shame." Hibbard's smile was like a fresh dent in soft fruit. He had a puppy's lush eyelashes, a head that invited stroking. "This interests you?" he said. "I have your full attention." Enid lowered her eyes and wondered if people ever died of sleep loss. Taking her silence for assent, Hibbard continued. "We think of a classic CNS depressant, such as alcohol, as suppressing shame or inhibitions. But the shameful admission that a person spills under the influence of 3 martinis doesn't lose its shamefulness in the spilling. Witness the deep remorse that follows when the martinis have worn off. What's happening on a molecular level, Edna, when you drink those martinis is that the ethanol interferes with the reception of excess factor 28A, that is, the deep or morbid shame factor. But the 28A is not metabolized or properly reabsorbed at the receptor site. It's kept in temporary, unstable storage at the transmitter site, so when the ethanol wears off, the receptor is flooded with 28A. Fear of humiliation and the craving for humiliation are closely linked. Psychologists know it. Russian novelists know it. And this turns out to be not only true, but really true. True at the molecular level. Anyway, Aslan's effect on the chemistry of shame is entirely different from a martini's. We're talking complete annihilation of the 28A molecules. Aslan's a fierce predator. Evidently, it was Enid's turn to speak now, but she'd missed a cue somewhere.
"Doctor," she said, "I'm sorry, but I haven't slept, and I'm a little confused."
The doctor frowned adorably. "Confused? Or confused?"
"Excuse me?"
"You've told me you are having trouble. You're carrying $150 in cash or traveler's checks. Based on your clinical responses, I've diagnosed subclinical dysthymia with no observable dementia, and I'm providing you free of charge with 8 sample packs of Aslan Cruiser, each containing 3 30-milligram capsules, so that you may comfortably enjoy the remainder of your cruise and afterward follow the recommended 30-20-10 step-down program. However, Eleanor, I must warn you right away that if you are confused, as opposed to merely confused, it may compel me to alter my diagnosis, which may well jeopardize your access to the Aslan." Here, Hibbard raised his eyebrows and whistled a few bars of a melody that his faux disingenuous smile robbed the tune of.
"I'm not confused," Enid said. "My husband is confused."
"If by confused you mean confused, then let me express the sincere hope that you intend the Aslan for your own use and not your husband's. Where dementia is present, Aslan is strongly contraindicated. Officially, therefore, I must insist that you use the medication only as directed and only under my strict supervision. In practice, though, I'm not naive. I understand that such a powerful, relief-bringing medication, a medication not yet available on the mainland, often finds its way into other hands." Hibbard whistled a few more tuneless bars, a cartoon of someone minding his own business while studying Enid to be sure he was amusing her.
"My husband gets strange at night sometimes," she said, averting her eyes. "Very agitated and difficult, and I can't sleep then. I'm dead tired all day and so upset, and there's so much I want to do."
"Aslan will help you," Hibbard assured her in a more sober voice. "A lot of travelers consider it a more important investment even than cancellation insurance. With all the money you've paid for the privilege of being here, Enith, you have a right to feel your best at every moment. A quarrel with your spouse, anxiety about a pet you've left behind, a perceived snub where none was intended. You can't afford these bad feelings. Think of it this way. If Aslan prevents you from missing just one prepaid pleasure lines activity due to your subclinical dysthymia, it has paid for itself, by which I mean that your flat fee consultation with me, at the end of which you'll receive 8 complimentary sample packs of 30-milligram Aslan Cruiser, has paid for itself."
"What is Aslan?"
Someone knocked on the outside door, and Hibbard shuddered as if to clear his head. "Edie, Eden, Edna, Enid, excuse me one moment." I'm beginning to understand that you really are confused about the state of the global art psychopharmacology that Pleasure Lines is proud to make available to its discerning clientele. I see you need a bit more explanation than most of our cruisers, and if you'll excuse me for just one moment." Hibbert took 8 sample packs of Aslan from his console, actually troubled to lock the console and pocket the key, and stepped into the vestibule. Enid heard his murmur and the husky voice of an older man replying, "25, Monday, and Newport." In less than 2 minutes the doctor returned, carrying some traveler's checks.
"Is this really all right, what you're doing?" Enid asked. "I mean, legally?"
"Good cue, Enid, but guess what? It's wonderfully legal." He examined one of the checks somewhat absently and then tucked them all into his shirt pocket.
"Excellent question, though. Really, ace cue. Professional ethics prevent me from selling the drugs I prescribe, so I'm confined to dispensing free samples, which luckily conforms to Pleasure Line's own tutto e incluso policy. Regrettably, since Aslan has yet to receive full American regulatory approval, and since most of our cruisers are American, and since Aslan's designer and maker, Pharmacopeia S.A., therefore has no incentive to provide me with complimentary samples sufficient to the extraordinary demand, I do find it necessary to purchase the complimentary samples in bulk, hence my consulting fee, which might otherwise strike some as inflated."
"What's the actual cash value of the 8 sample packs?" Enid asked.
"Being complimentary and strictly not for resale, they have no actual cash value, Eartha. If you're asking what it costs me to provide this service to you free of charge, the answer is about $88 U.S.
$4 a pill.
Correct. Full dosage for patients of ordinary sensitivity is 30 milligrams per day, in other words, 1 caplet. $4 a day to feel great. Most cruisers consider it a bargain."
"And tell me, though, what it is, Ashram?"
"Aslan. Named, I'm told, for a mythical creature in ancient mythology. Mithraism, sun worshippers, and so forth. I'd be making it up if I told you any more, but my understanding is Aslan was a great benign lion." Enid's heart leaped in its cage. She took a sample pack from the desk and examined the pills through the bubbles of hard plastic. Each tawny gold caplet was scored twice for ease of splitting and emblazoned with a many-rayed sun, or was it the silhouetted head of a richly maned lion? Aslan, registered, Cruiser, trademark, was the label.
"What's it do?" she said.
"Absolutely nothing," Hibbert replied, "if you're in perfect mental health. However, let's face it, who is?"
"Oh, and if you're not?"
"Aslan provides state-of-the-art factor regulation. The best medications now approved for American use are like 2 Marlboros and a rum and coke by comparison."
"It's an antidepressant?"
"Crude term. Personality optimizer is the phrase I prefer."
"And cruiser?"
"Aslan optimizes in 16 chemical dimensions," Hibbert said patiently. "But guess what? Optimal for a person enjoying a luxury cruise isn't optimal for a person functioning in the workplace. The chemical differences are pretty subtle, but if you're capable of fine control, why not offer it? Besides Aslan Basic, Pharmacopeia sells 8 custom blends, Aslan Ski, Aslan Hacker, Aslan Performance Ultra, Aslan Teen, Aslan Club Med, Aslan Golden Years, and I'm forgetting what, Aslan California, very popular in Europe. The plan is to bring the number of blends up to 20 within 2 years. Aslan Exam Buster, Aslan Courtship, Aslan White Knights, Aslan Reader's Challenge, Aslan Connoisseur Class, yada yada yada. American regulatory approval would accelerate the process, but I'm not holding my breath. If you're asking what's specific to Cruiser, mainly that it switches your anxiety to the off position. Turns that little dial right down to 0. Aslan Basic won't do that because to function day-to-day, a moderate anxiety level is desirable. I'm on Basic right now, for example, because I'm working.
How?
Less than 1 hour. That's the glory of it. The action is effectively instantaneous.
That's compared with up to 4 weeks for some of the dinosaurs they're still using stateside. Go on Zoloft today, and you're lucky to feel better a week from Friday.
No, but how do I refill the prescription at home?
Hibbard looked at his watch. What part of the country are you from, Andy?
The Midwest, St. Jude.
Okay, your best bet's going to be Mexican, Aslan. Or if you have friends vacationing in Argentina or Uruguay, you might work something out with them. Obviously, if you like the medication and you want total ease of access, Pleasure Lines hopes you'll take another cruise.
Enid pulled a scowl. Dr. Hibbard was very handsome and charismatic, and she liked the idea of a pill that would help her enjoy the cruise and take better care of Alfred. But the doctor seemed to her a trifle glib. Also, her name was Enid, E-N-I-D.
"You're really, really, really sure this will help me?" she said. "You're really super certain this is the best thing for me?"
"I guarantee it," Hibbard said with a wink.
"What does optimize mean, though?" Enid said.
"You'll feel emotionally more resilient," Hibbard said. "More flexible, more confident, happier with yourself. Your anxiety and oversensitivity will disappear, as will any morbid concern about the opinion of others. Anything you're ashamed of now—"
"Yes," Enid said. "Yes.
If it comes up, I'll talk about it. If not, why mention it? That will be your attitude. The vicious bipolarity of shame, that rapid cycling between confession and concealment—this is a complaint of yours?"
"I think you understand me."
"Chemicals in your brain, Elaine. A strong urge to confess. A strong urge to conceal. What's a strong urge? What else can it be but chemicals? What's memory? A chemical change. Or maybe a structural change. But guess what? Structures are made of proteins. And what are proteins made of? Amines." Enid had the dim worry that her church taught otherwise. Something about Christ being both a hunk of flesh hanging from a cross and also the Son of God, but questions of doctrine had always seemed to her forbiddingly complex, and Reverend Anderson at their church had such a kindly face and often in his sermons told jokes or quoted New Yorker cartoons or secular writers such as John Updike, and he never did anything disturbing like telling the congregation that it was damned, which would have been absurd since everyone at the church was so friendly and nice, and then, too, Alfred had always pooh-poohed her faith, and it was easier just to stop believing, if in fact she ever had believed, than to try to beat Alfred in a philosophical argument. Now Enid believed that when you were dead, you were really dead, and Dr. Hibbard's account of things was making sense to her. Nevertheless, being a tough shopper, she said, "I'm just a dumb old Midwesterner, but changing your personality doesn't sound right to me." She made her face long and sour, to be sure her disapproval wasn't overlooked. "What's wrong with change?" Hibbard said. "Are you happy with the way you feel right now?"
"Well, no, but if I'm a different person after I take this pill, if I'm different, that can't be right, and—"
"Edwina, I'm completely sympathetic. We all have irrational attachments to the particular chemical coordinates of our character and temperament. It's a version of the fear of death, right? I don't know what it would be like not to be me anymore. But guess what? If I'm not around to tell the difference, then what do I really care? Being dead's only a problem if you know you're dead, which you never do because you're dead."
"But it sounds like the drug makes everybody the same."
"Uh-uh. Beep, beep. Wrong. Because guess what? Two people can have the same personality and still be individuals. Two people with the same IQ can have completely different knowledge and memories, right? Two very affectionate people can have completely different objects of affection. Two identically risk-averse individuals may be avoiding completely different risks. Maybe Aslan does make us a little more alike, but guess what, Enid? We're all still individuals."
The doctor unleashed an especially lovable smile, and Enid, who calculated that he was netting $62 per consultation, decided that she'd now received her money's worth of his time and attention, and she did what she'd known she would do since she first laid eyes on the sunny Leonine Caplets. She reached into her purse, and from the Pleasure Lines envelope that held her slot winnings, she took a handful of cash and counted out $150. "All joy of the lion," Hibbard said with a wink as he slid the stack of sample packs across his desk. "Do you need a bag for that?" With a pounding heart, Enid made her way to the bow of the B-deck. After the nightmare of the previous day and nights, she again had a concrete thing to look forward to. And how sweet the optimism of the person carrying a newly scored drug that she believed would change her head! How universal the craving to escape the givens of the self! No exertion more strenuous than raising hand to mouth, no act more violent than swallowing. No religious feeling, no faith in anything more mystical than cause and effect was required to experience a pill's transformative blessings. She couldn't wait to take it. She treaded on air all the way to B-11, where happily she saw no sign of Alfred. As if to acknowledge the illicit nature of her mission, she threw the deadbolt on the hall door, further locked herself inside the bathroom, raised her eyes to their reflected twins, and, on a ceremonial impulse, returned their gaze as she hadn't in months or maybe years. Pushed one golden Aslan through the foil backing of its sample pack, placed it on her tongue, and swallowed it with water. For a few minutes, she brushed and flossed, a bit of oral housekeeping to pass the time. Then, with a shudder of cresting exhaustion, she went to her bed to lie and wait. Golden sunlight fell across the blankets in her windowless room. He nuzzled her palm with his warm velvet snout. He licked her eyelids with a tongue both sandpapery and slick. His breath was sweet and gingery. When she came awake, the cool halogen lighting in the stateroom wasn't artificial anymore. It was the cool light of sun from behind a momentary cloud. "I've taken the medication," she told herself. "I've taken the medication. I've taken the medication." Her new emotional flexibility received a bold challenge the next morning when she rose at 7 and discovered Alfred curled up, fast asleep, in the shower stall.
"Al, you're lying in the shower," she said. "This is not the place to sleep."
Having awakened him, she began to brush her teeth. Alfred opened undemented eyes and took stock. "Ugh, I am stiff, stiff," he said.
"What on earth are you doing in there?"
Enid gurgled through a fluoride foam, brushing merrily away. "Got all turned..."